It is my hope that most of us have childhood friends. The friends that we make when we are just a few years old are special. When we are young, we come together because we want to share fun with each other. Childhood friends help shape perceptions and attitude. They are people to experiment with, throwing around new ideas and unattempted feats of mental and physical heroism. Being a kid is something a majority of us look back at fondly, and I believe a large portion of those great memories we made as kids were accompanied by equally great friends. In a way, the COVID-19 pandemic was an opportunity to revert to what it was like as kids. Being stuck in a house, not having any need to go anywhere outside of the neighborhood, it became just as exciting to see neighbors walking past my front room window as they try to mitigate the intimidating ramifications of cabin fever. When I was a kid, very little time was ever spent inside, and whatever time I did end up spending inside, I spent it playing James Bond 007 Nightfire and Super Mario Strikers for the GameCube. Before LAN parties and squatting up was a thing, you went over to a friend's house to share controllers on one game console. When I got tired of Team Deathmatch, my first inclination was to play soccer. I did not know how lucky I was to have two twin boys two houses down from mine that also had a GameCube and also pursued the sport of soccer. As a disclaimer, it was just as important to have my brother, who also played soccer, as a motivating force to improve on my game. However, in the scope of this conversation, I need to set the stage for my guest today. He's one of those two twin boys. He, his brother, my brother, and I would hold conversation together for hours while passing the ball around in the street, making soccer trick shot montages, or trying oh so carefully to make sure Calvin, their dog, didn't chew up another soccer ball. Having childhood friends is special. Having childhood friends that you get to say you are still close friends with is even more special. My guest today has an absolutely persistent work ethic and a heart as big as his smile. He is an adept communicator, a brilliant thinker, and an absolutely great Super Mario Strikers teammate. He has accomplished many great things and has faced even greater challenges in his life. He has been an influential figure to me since the first days of my life that I can actually remember. And luckily for all of us today, we get to sit down, and talk with him on the podcast for the very first time. Everyone, please welcome the one and only Colin Whitehead. Colin, welcome to the show.
Hey, Connor. Thanks.
So, how you been, man? I feel like, every time that I try to actually see you, you end up being like in some other country.
Yeah, you know, happens a lot, I guess.
So, why don't you kind of set the stage for people, kind of where you are in your life right now, so we can kind of like talk about everything that got you here.
Sure. Well, I'm 25. Right now, I'm pursuing a master's degree in theology at the University of Notre Dame.
Cool.
But because of COVID, I've been home for the last 4 or 5 months taking classes online. And I guess that's not been such a bad thing, spending a lot of time at home, being involved in the life of the neighborhood again, mm-hmm. Not being in a foreign country. So now I see him much more often. But I guess that's kind of where I'm at right now, just kind of in a place of sitting and waiting.
Yeah, I can understand that. So with this theology degree, is this something that you've always wanted to pursue? Is this something that you kind of like fell into? Like how did we get to I'm pursuing a theology degree, a theology's master?
Definitely wasn't something I always wanted to do, much more something that I fell into. I'd always wanted to be a veterinarian. And then my dad had always encouraged my brother Logan and I, my twin brother, to pursue business. So I kind of had this very kind of New York lifestyle and mentality that I was set on pursuing. But when I got to high school, we both went to Detroit Catholic Central. Mm-hmm. I met some of the priest there, and they invited me one time to come over to their residence, hang out for a bit, and think about pursuing a life as a priest. And I'd never wanted to do that at all. Really, kind of, I was kind of anti that lifestyle. And I guess ever since then, though, little by little, year by year, the more I talked to them, the other people who recognized something in me, the more I thought, well, maybe I have something else to offer people, something else to offer people in need. And it's not necessarily by becoming famous or kind of pursuing the dreams I always thought I had. Just kind of stumbled into it.
Yes, and I think something that's cool about you saying that is like literally whenever we were hanging out as kids, like Logan and Alex really got along because they were just on the same wavelength. And then you were kind of like always the person to ask questions. You're always like trying to get the water for people when they came over to the house or whatever it was, like to make us comfortable. Like you always serve others, just, you know, that's just in your human nature. So I guess in that aspect of things, I could easily see you kind of going down this path. Wasn't even awkward. It was literally like sometimes people are like very like, would you like water? You're just like, when can I get you a glass of water? Or like, you know, whenever like you came over to the house, you're always like trying to make sure everything is like, everybody's okay, everybody's safe type of thing. So.
Yep. Gotta be a good host. Gotta make sure people feel welcome.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of in the same place. So like we're probably like, I don't know, in a group of friends, would you consider yourself to be the dad? I mean,
yeah,
I would.
I guess so.
I take pride in my dadisms with the group. So, you know, but yeah. So, I mean, for everybody that's, you know, on the podcast, so Colin and I literally like Colin, his brother Logan, me and my brother Alex. I mean, like we spend every day outside, right? I mean, it was almost every day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, compared to what most kids are doing now, which, you know, like I see some playing basketball outside or, you know, whatever sport it might be. But I mean, like there wasn't ever a time that we weren't together with a soccer ball, just like knocking the ball around and just hanging out.
Yep. And it wasn't because our parents kind of kicked us out because we were playing too much video games or something like that. It was, we just loved hanging out outside and there were always guys who were willing to do it with us.
Yeah. And I mean, that was probably like one of them. I like remember vividly the day that y'all went to college, at least Logan went to school, or maybe it was both of you. It was pretty much both of you at the same time.
Same day, same morning.
And I remember I went over to your garage and I didn't even like think about it, but like until after, so I saw you in your garage. I said hi, I said bye, like just kind of general goodbye. And then I just remember like walking back to my garage and be like, this is the last time I'm ever going to consistently see these people ever again. That was the first moment of that feeling. It's pretty heavy.
It is. Yeah. And it feels like it's the last time. And in some ways it is. I mean, it's the end of one thing, beginning of another, but I guess once you pass that threshold and you're living kind of the next stage in life, you look back and you see that, I mean, while things have changed, we still come home plenty, still home for the summers during college. We're home now kind of strangely during COVID. And, you know, these kinds of opportunities to see each other again just present themselves when you least expect it.
Yeah, I mean, it makes things that much more joyful. Like, even as I was saying earlier, it's like, even as, you know, kids, we kind of just take for granted, like, that we could just go outside and play soccer. But then there's that moment where I said, like, there's literally, like, there's nothing else to do. There's, like, nobody else really in the neighborhood that I was, like, super close with. So, and it was always like that. Even to backtrack, it was even like that in high school. Because I remember when you went to CC, I was in eighth grade. So I was a year below, and I basically was in the midst of kind of like a decision, like, where do I go to high school? Most people are like straight to public school, don't even question it. And then for me, I see you and Logan just you know, coming home in khakis and a polo, and I'm just like, yeah, I guess I gotta go here. I mean, you guys literally, I mean, once you went there, you never stopped talking about it, but nor, you know, I did the same thing. I mean, Catholic Central High School, for anybody who doesn't know, is a private all guys high school. It's really just like a big fraternity.
Yes, it is.
Cause how would you describe Catholic Central? Like when you went as a freshman, like, do you remember any of the thoughts going through your head going through like kind of a freshman, sophomore year of high school?
Oh yeah. Kind of another one of those threshold moments where you just don't know what's ending and what's beginning. But it was definitely a break from a lot of friendships I'd had in grade school. Not a lot of guys I knew were going to Catholic Central. And I remember very distinctly the very first day. It wasn't a day of classes. They just had an orientation for an hour or so. And they sat us down in the gym and they brought out the dean of students.
And the mannequin.
And the mannequin. And he gave his I hate freshman speech.
That is a famous speech.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So he put the fear of God in us, and we thought you all hated us, but it was a kind of a good way to instill discipline, which is one of the things that Catholic Central does really well.
Yep. One of the three tenets: goodness, discipline, and knowledge. But that's actually, so it's cool that you mentioned that. I mean, like, since then they turned the dean of students into the dean of discipline, Mr. Hancock, which is still fun, but to like kind of just look at. But in the scope of this conversation is, you know, very early on, we were instilled with some like wicked different kind of set of core values when it came, especially to discipline. Like, how much time would you say you spent, you know, on homework average throughout high school, in high school?
See, we got home at like 3:15, 3:30, and we'd work on it until probably midnight, sometimes later. Oh, yep. Man.
Like that first day, they were like famous for saying, be like, yeah, you're going to walk out of here with 2 hours of homework tonight. Like, it's first day and we're going to have like, you know, 2 hours of homework at least. And that was back when we had the heavy books too. So like you'd spend the whole day with these like 50-pound textbooks, and then you'd have to lug them around all class period.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, in the scheme of things, how well did the discipline and the structure of going through kind of a more private high school education like that prepare you kind of for that next chapter, like when you went off to college?
Well, it was certainly a privilege. I know not a lot of people have that opportunity, but it did prepare us so well. I remember thinking that my first semester of college academically was just easier because I'd already had all the disciplines and the good study habits. I expected to work on homework basically all day long when I wasn't in class.
Mm-hmm.
So it for sure, you know, gave me a running start into college and made all the other things that make the transition to college, like leaving your family, it made all that stuff at least a little bit more manageable. You could focus on that instead.
Yeah, that's a really cool way to put it. Like, I remember there's our valedictorian the next year, he talked about like how even like he had more like struggles with his family, but the one thing that actually kept him straight was doing the homework, was, you know, being the academic, because it was something just to apply yourself to. Just, you know, there's literally nothing besides, like, for him it was wrestling and school homework. So you know, that I think that's something that resides in a lot of people that go to CC or goes to CC and then beyond. I mean, for myself, and there's kind of like two people that kind of divert from CC. There's, I'd probably say, like, and I mean this objectively, there's somebody like you where like the discipline's there, it just sticks, this is the way of life. And then there's somebody like me where like I'm always like, grass might be greener on the other side, man. And I'm just like, balls to the wall. I went from like freshman year of college, I was great, I was fine, like I was a, you know, 3.0 plus kid. And then about my junior year, I just said like, what the hell am I doing? Like, I'm not even like having, like, I'm just not having the college experience that I thought I was gonna have. And I kind of just like, I didn't give up, but I was just like, this doesn't matter. Like, high school mattered more to me than CMU. So I was just kind of like, all right, like, let's just go enjoy ourselves. Let's go have fun. So kind of that that air of discipline was so gone from my system. And I, and it's something that slips away super fast for me. Would you agree?
Definitely. It's a habit that if you don't exercise it, it's gone.
It's like a muscle. And I didn't realize, I didn't learn about kind of like what, how the brain is really just a muscle. It's just, you're contracting and then relaxing this muscle in your head. So when it comes to discipline or any type of habit, you know, for us, it was kind of like fear instilled our discipline. And then some of that caught on. And then for me, I was like, I'm not afraid of you. So like, I'm not going to, you know, worry. I don't care. I don't worry about discipline. So I need a new trigger. So that kind of like, you know, that, you know, discipline comes from a lot of different places. Some of it's self-motivated, some of it's motivated by environment. Would you say that, what, like, how, where would you say motivation comes from within you? Like, is it from you or from your environment?
I'd say a lot of it is from my environment. A lot of it is from a sense of responsibility to others, a sense of someone's counting on me, I got to pull through. When it's just left to me, I would say that unless it's something I'm very, very passionate about, it's much harder to get myself out of bed every day and do it.
What kind of like, do you have any, do you have like an inner monologue?
Oh yeah, for sure. Probably too much.
What is like an inner monologue for you when like, you're just kind of like, yeah, this isn't happening today?
Well, it's kind of hard to go meta on it and think about it a little bit, but, I mean, it's certainly, it's always kind of a fight against your conscience. You're wrestling with, am I going to do this? Am I not going to do this? And when I don't do it, I always know I'm kind of working against myself here. But as far as like what the actual words of the conversation would be, I don't know. Maybe it's more feelings.
Just that kind of that like intuitive, like just that inner self is just kind of like, you know, you're going to do A or you're going to do B, like you kind of just feel this natural inclination, I guess, is what I'm saying. Okay. Because like my dialogue, like you said, like there's a lot of stuff going on. Like there's always a crazy conversation going in my head. But I mentioned that because as of recent, like as I try to build better habits and try to be, you know, enforce new habits or try to start something new, I kind of get this like drill sergeant in my head. And it's almost just like, he kind of like almost counts down from five. He's just like, I think he spawned from my running. Like, do you get voices in your head when you run or anything like that? So I think spawning from running, I was like laying in bed the other day and I just hear this like drill sergeant in my head, like, I am counting to five, get out of bed. And I'm just like, oh shit. Like in my head, I'm like, oh God, he's like counting down. He's like 4, 3. And I'm like, oh, and it's like 8 o'clock in the morning. And I went to bed at like 2. So I'm tired. And then one hits. He's like, if you don't get off the fucking floor, I'm flooring you. And I'm like, all right, we're getting up. And so like, I just yeeted myself out of bed. I was like scared out of my mind. And I was just like, maybe fear is my maybe fear is a great discipline, but I've never feared a lot of people in my life. So I don't know. Inner monologue is, I guess what I mean to say by all this is inner monologue is just as important, I think, in your environment, in the scope of this conversation, because when you're alone, like nobody's accountable for yourself except for yourself.
Good point, Connor. Yes. If you don't have an accountability partner, you gotta somehow build it in.
Sorry, taking some water.
No, it's also critical for self-reflection, I think, growing self-knowledge, figuring out what you like, what you don't like, figuring out when you need to ask for help. It's really important to have that kind of internal conversation.
Asking for help, that's a tough one.
Yeah, especially as a guy.
Why as a guy?
Well, I just have the classic kind of, like guys don't like to ask for help with instructions type thing. Don't like to ask for directions when they're lost or something. So,
that's you. Would you say that dictates your behavior, or would you say you move past that?
I would say I move past that. Once I became aware of it, I tried to work toward it. So like whenever I'm I don't know, say like Home Depot or something, and I'm looking for a part, I'm not going to waste all day looking on my own. I'll just ask someone.
Yes, I agree. So I mentioned how a run kind of shaped maybe a voice in my self monologue, or like my inner dialogue. Like, do you have, is there like any certain time or situation, or is there just a, like, was there a moment where you said like, you know what, there's a different voice in my head that's kind of like, you know, kind of calling the shots once in a while here?
Yeah, I would say so. Not to go down a rabbit hole, but just to go back briefly to kind of my discernment of the priesthood. I guess from all the time that I spent with those priests at Catholic Central, it kind of helped me to at least look for some kind of other voice, or pay attention to maybe something that wasn't necessarily what I perceived to be me, kind of moving me in this direction towards where I am now in theology. I don't think that could have necessarily come from me. I think it was me kind of listening either to voices around me, or the voice of God as I perceived it in kind of the movements of my life and little signals here and there.
Yeah, that's great. How, like, would you say you were a good listener when you started?
I think actually probably was more when I was a kid. I don't think there was as much kind of, I don't think there was as much noise around me and as much kind of probably internal monologue as we've been talking about. But as I've gotten older, there's just so many other distractions, and now I never really have time where I'm bored because I'm always just going from one thing to another, whether it's studies or work or, you know, the little free time we have to hang out outside.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I was a much better listener when I was a kid, but now not so much. I'm trying to work on that again.
You said you were better as a kid. That's actually really interesting. Just based off of our conversations, listening is so important in conversation, especially in the scope of having a meaningful, productive conversation. So when I, when I'm hearing you say like, there wasn't as much noise. I mean, as kids, we have attention spans like squirrels, and then, we get bored easily because there's just not enough for us to do. Like we'll do something and then we're not developed enough to remain on a task for a certain amount of time. And we develop that muscle later on, that listening muscle where we can pay attention to what we're doing. Like, I think I remember as a kid, like I used to always be terrible at knots. And for some reason, I feel like you like helped me solve a knot one time. And it was like the first time I'd ever actually experience like patience, like taking your time, because a lot of times as a kid you get a knot and you're just like shaking around, you're like, how do I get this knot undone, and then I don't know why I'm remembering this now, but I do remember like a moment where like I think
no recollection on my side.
I remember weird things. I like legitimate about this, like I remember like it was a, I don't know if it was a speaker wire, like a wire or something at your house, but I think it might have been like a speaker cable at your house or something. But because we were playing hide and seek, and I think I was like in one of your bins when we were playing hide and seek, and then I like found a speaker. But so anyway, so I found this knot and I was just yanking at it, and I remember you kind of just being like, well, follow where it goes from and then just go from there. And I'm like, okay. And in a way that for me, that's kind of a metaphor for listening, because a lot of times people see this knot, they see this conversation, like they see conversation just as this jumbling of words, they see just the knot, they don't see the single wire wrapping itself around. And then when you listen, when you take the patience to like see where the knot starts and ends, and you can kind of like weave yourself into the conversation, you can listen your way back from the end of the wire back to the beginning and untie this knot. So in the scope of listening, the reason I bring this up is like, so you were talking about, like you hear another voice, like where, where would you say you kind of heard another voice? Like, was there a specific environment that you heard one?
Do you mean like with myself or yeah. do you mean kind of?
Yeah, you said we're going down the rabbit hole. We're going down the rabbit hole.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I do separate God from conscience. I think conscience is more, at least as I understand it at this point, is more kind of internal to me, whereas, you know, I mean, conscience is something you have to form, so I don't think it can necessarily be God's voice. It could reflect God's voice, but as to where I heard that voice, I don't know, my head. It's hard to say.
Well, I'm saying, like, were you in a specific environment? Were you, like, in a church? Were you...
I mean, for me, it was, some people might have that kind of moment in a one specific place. For example, in a church, if they like hear God's voice guiding them to do something, there's famous stories of saints like St. Francis of Assisi, heard a voice, rebuild my church. For me, though, I think it's been much more just a series of moments and not necessarily one place. Sometimes not even necessarily a voice, just like a sense of, I'm kind of feeling moved to do something. It's kind of more of a feeling. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to describe.
It is hard to describe because I have a similar feeling when I'm in like a forest. To me, my chapel is my forest. I truly believe there is some type of psychoactive effect of being in such a deep natural environment, especially with like aged trees. Like when you go to the redwoods in California, have you been?
I have not. Have you?
I have.
Really? And I didn't know
that. So I went early in the morning with my dad. It was like 8 in the morning, 7 in the morning, something like that. Like right as the park opened up, dawn. And it was just so ridiculously quiet. And I think because of that silence, I could hear the trees. Like I could feel their presence. I could, you stood by them. They could talk where they were like, I put my hand on one and I could just feel like some type of weird, raw, natural energy. This is the first time I've ever felt it like in nature. Like normally I thought like, you know, I wasn't naturally, like I was religious by discipline, but I wasn't naturally that spiritual. And I put my hand on this redwood and I was like, there's something here, man. Like, we're not alone, man. These things can, they see and they understand. That was my first time with having a conversation with a tree, if that sounds dumb enough. But that is where I heard a voice. I heard a voice through nature, not necessarily through any other place. But it extremely impacted my life in a way that was extremely delayed. Like I heard that voice when I think I was like a senior in high school. And then throughout my first 3 years of college, it was pretty much just like, I don't know what the hell I was in kind of first 3 years of college, just figuring it out. But in the scheme of this, listening to a tree, listening to nature, listening to an ecosystem provide for itself and to just hear its activity, for me, that's kind of that helped develop my voice, this kind of like inner peace, maybe.
Are you a Star Wars fan?
Am I a Star Wars fan?
Yes. Have you seen episode, I think it's 8? It's where like they go into this great explanation of the Force like they've never done before. And Rey's just sitting on this rock on that like Irish kind of aisle. And she puts her hands down on the rock and she can, this is when Luke is like teaching her how to get a sense of the Force. And she just kind of feels like some kind of voice or movement going through the rock and then through like the birds and through her. And there's just kind of this one symbiotic thing that runs through all of creation. And can't help but think of that as a good description or picture to paint of what you're saying.
I'm a Jedi.
So you're special. Not all of us have this talking to tree moment.
Yeah, I'm not a tree hugger. I'm a tree talker. I'm like a different breed of weird. I like this rabbit hole. I like hearing about having to kind of like be quiet, to listen. It's something that we don't do enough, I think, today, which we have so many notifications. We have so many kind of things we are attending to. I mean, the amount of tasks that we need to do now versus in the past, like if we were this age, but like in the 90s, let's say, like when we grew, if we were us now, but in, you know, 95, 96, you know, what the hell would, you know, we be doing? We'd probably be doing half as much as what we would be doing now.
Mm-hmm. I feel like when we were kids, there was just time to get bored. But nowadays and it was kind of that boredom that just is agonizing. It just lingers and there's just nothing you can nothing fun you can figure out to fill your time with. But nowadays it's not necessarily even fun stuff that I fill my time with, but just busyness. And I never feel that sense of boredness where you can just hear the ringing in your ears.
Yeah, I get the ringing in the ears, but I don't think it's from boredom. It's from too many concerts, but so, and you know, obviously this conversation naturally revolves around our childhood, just because we spent so much time in that period of time together. And during that time, you know, obviously it's it's your life, but, if you're free to speak about it, I mean, something that you had, so in the scheme of discipline and challenging ourselves, I mean, you had such a wicked challenge, early on in your life. Are you open to talking about pandas at all?
Yeah. We'll have to have a disclaimer about the acronym though, but yes, definitely.
All right. So why don't you give us the disclaimer on pandas to start with? Can you explain what pandas is?
Yeah. So when I was 13, 14, I had this medical condition. At the time, I didn't know what it was, but it's kind of related to the after effects of having a strep infection. I can't remember exactly what the acronym is. It's something like pediatric autoimmune neuro disorder associated with strep. Really bad acronym. It's a stigma for anyone who has it. But at the time, like I said, it wasn't actually recognized by the National Institutes of Health, things like that. So it was all kind of experimental. And I came to learn that a lot of people actually have this. I couldn't give any solid statistics, but somewhere in the millions, where it's just, you know, kids, especially kids, have too many antibodies that build up trying to fight this infection, and it kind of lingers in their system and inhibits some of the mental functions going on. And that in turn gives you, what it looks like is this: you have extreme OCD or Tourette's, and you basically just cease being a functional human being, so to speak.
What was the biggest impact of the condition on, would you say there's an impact that it had on your life?
Oh yeah, for sure. And by the way, thanks for, I'm really kind of moved that and grateful that you remember what it's called. You remember what it was like for me. I've actually never really talked to you about this in person. I could only kind of perceive what you guys might have thought was going on, but I didn't know how much you really understood what was happening.
Yeah, we were kind of clueless.
That's where.
Then again, you going through it and your family going through it, in a way, you guys were clueless too. You guys were getting information as it was happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like COVID right now, where it's kind of it's a little bit like COVID, where this is uncharted territory. We don't know what the hell is going on here. We need to figure this out.
Yeah, it's a good analogy. I would say you kind of just hit it on the head, Connor. The family piece is what was most disrupted, because I remember my parents were just basically crying and late at night because they had no idea what was going on. And I was causing them so much stress. I was getting really angry at them and physically violent. And they just spent hours searching in the night online, trying to find a doctor, trying to find someone who could help us. We went through 20 doctors. But that was the most disruptive thing, was just the stress it caused for my parents and my brother. And since then, I've had a chance to work with several kids who have been diagnosed with this. Now it's recognized, at least more so recognized in the medical community. And that's what all the parents say who I talk to, is it's just so taxing on the family.
Wow. I mean, I can only imagine 20 doctors, that's, I mean, were you guys looking just like anywhere in the country?
Pretty much, yeah. Maryland, Chicago. We ended up going to Chicago for my treatment. That's kind of the end result there.
And so like you get to Chicago, by this time, how long have you had you had pandas?
I've had it for 4 years.
It's 4 years, yeah. It's something, yeah, I was either thinking it was like 3 to 5 years, so 4 years. Mm-hmm. And then, so you go to Chicago, and then what's kind of like the timetable of application of like medicine and recovery? Like what's kind of like from where you were to like kind of where you felt like yourself again?
So I got what's called an IVIG treatment. It's where they introduce new like plasma or antibodies into your bloodstream.
Okay.
And so I got that done in Chicago. It was a 2-day treatment. They just kind of hook you up to an IV all day. And then I had to go back 3 months later for another one. And then after that, it was probably like a year before I would say I started to feel normal and I wasn't kind of controlled by obsessive thoughts anymore. I mean, I think there's still a little bit of OCD that always lingers with you. But it's hard to say whether that's like a byproduct of my condition or just kind of the natural kind of OCD that anyone can have.
I remember your dad said that to me, and then at the time I didn't even know what it, like kind of what OCD was, but now that I'm in design, now that I've kind of I obsessively compulsively design in a certain way, like I would almost say it's probably an advantage to you to have something that is more of an inner critic. I mean, like that's to have you know, some type of like that's kind of a it's kind of a cool battle scar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
if you want to look at it positively.
Mm-hmm. It's allowed me to empathize with a lot of people that I previously didn't, and now also to, like I mentioned, to kind of walk with some teenagers that are really having a tough time. There's one kid I'm still in contact with right now, and he's now in college. He's kind of been going up and down, I guess, with his. Unfortunately, it's still lingering a little bit. But yeah, it's been great to have both people who walked with me, but now me being able to offer that for others.
Yeah, that's just pretty wild. Like, was your specific case something that they now study for other people?
Not to my knowledge of me specifically. I mean, I think I'm probably in their stats somewhere as just a number, but okay. not necessarily, like studied on a personal basis.
Right. Yeah. I'm just thinking like, I was seeing like some college professor in Chicago that's like got like one of those 3-panel whiteboards. Like it's the science fair, but in college, and it's just like, pandas, what is it and how does it work? And like, you're just like a research paper.
I mean, some kids. Go ahead, sorry.
No, finish.
I mean, there are some kids who they have, yeah, they've studied like that. And I mean, there's a book called Saving Sammy, and it's also been made into like a documentary. So if your listeners want to just like Google that for 30 seconds, it'll give them, like the trailer for that will give them an idea.
And you said it's like Saving Sammy, it's on like a website?
Yeah, it's just, I think it's like on YouTube or something.
Okay. Yeah, Saving Sammy. I mean, Google can do us some magic, but yeah, man, like, I mean, just, I felt more so bad because I'm like, dog, you're going to like lose the game. Like you're like, snap out of a dog. Like, I mean, what I'm describing here is like, Colin would just go into, would you just consider it a seizure?
Sometimes, yeah. Seizure-like, I mean, things.
Yeah, just kind of like a small seizure-like movement. And I'm just like, dog, like, we got a game to win here. Like, let's go. And you're just like, you're in your zone. And I felt so bad. And like, in a way, like, Logan kind of paved the right path, I think, for what you were going through, which is to not stigmatize it, but just to kind of like normalize it, which made me feel a lot better, where your brother would kind of just be like, Colin, like, it for... In like modern day terms, he'd be like, get your shit together. Let's go. Like, come on, we got this. And for me and Alex, we're just like, you know, we're so sheltered. Like my brother and I are so sheltered that we see this and we're just like, well, this is happening. This is fun. But in a way, I mean, like, it just brought us so much closer as friends, because it's like, that's such a, that's a vulnerable thing to want to, you know, continue. Like, it's isolating in a way to have something like that. Like, I can only imagine people that have like COVID now. I mean, not to relate the symptoms the same, but like, just the premise of, okay, so you've gotten COVID and then you got the antibodies, but you kind of almost like, you know, people are still kind of like wary of people that might have COVID. People are still wary about like just sickness in general. You know, so to have really like, I mean, I feel like if you didn't have a support system, things could have gone a lot differently.
Oh yeah, for sure. I thought for a while that, I mean, when you're in that moment as a kid having that problem, you don't understand what's going on, you think things like, wow, I'm never going to get out of this, or yeah, who knows how long I'll live, or something like that. I mean, it was a real question of whether I would continue on at school in high school, whether I'd even be able to go to college and function on my own.
Hmm. I mean, look, you're here today, and you're not only that, but you're getting a master's. I mean, that's just in so many ways, you've been such a persistent model of like, just get up and keep moving. And I took that for granted, I think, for so long, until like going away to college, like, you know, I don't think we realized just like how good of like a, like how good of an open, honest, like intelligent friendship we kind of had between the four of us. Compared to like, I would say, like in general, like we bonded over different things than, you know, the friends that we have now. You know, we kind of bonded over the love of soccer and food and school. But in general, like, it's fun how I saw you at the beginning of like, I think it was like last summer. I think I had just come back from Ann Arbor. And I think you had just come back from school or something like that. Or Peru, maybe it was Peru you'd come back from. Mm-hmm. And you basically like, we, you know, we started chit chatting, and then, you know, we each have busy lives, and I've always been terrible at kind of like following up or texting back or anything like that. Like, it's something in kind of my anxiety of conversation, you know, like making decisions in a verbal, like, or in a written text form sometimes is actually a super anxious thing. I don't know why, but just the way it is. And I try to figure it out. Like, this podcast is something that I would say actually helps with my anxiety, because it's like, I have this thing that I must do, like, no matter what, it's going to happen. And so if it's going to happen, I'm going to have to be extremely deliberate, extremely direct about scheduling time, you know, just even in conversation, being very direct, really kind of laying a platform for people to have conversation. You know, are there any activities that help you kind of like you said, you still kind of have that like OCD, like, can you kind of describe that? Like, is that something that like is still kind of like affecting you today?
Yeah, I think probably a lot of people listening could relate to it, just in terms of like perfectionism. I think that's one common thing that a lot of people experience, which will give them good insight into what I experienced. It's just kind of a, you know, you have a hard time letting go of, you know, something you're really working toward or excited about or frustrated by. It's kind of hard to let go of feelings sometimes. Things just kind of cling to you. And so it's, I find things like exercising to be very helpful to just change my mindset. I love soccer still, so that's my favorite thing to do. That's pretty restorative.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that you mentioned that, because in this, you know, I always like, I mean, anywhere I went, I ran. Like, it was not a question. Like, I pretty much anywhere I was at, whether I was in the school hallway or on the soccer field, I was running. And, you know, I think maybe that was something I took for granted, was kind of the physical aspect of my first like 18 years of life, you know, and probably for you too. I mean, like, you know, you spent majority of your life now running and playing soccer, playing sports. It's so beneficial for your brain.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I'm not very good with bio, which, I mean, I've probably already made a couple mistakes here talking about my own, you know, disorder back there. But I think it, you know, releases endorphins and all that other stuff that makes you feel good and helps you kind of relax.
I mean, in a way, running really made me understand, like, I think humans are built to run, man. Like, we're built to move like that. Mm-hmm. We are machines.
Yep. And again, I don't think that your listeners would mind me speaking kind of from my perspective, this kind of religious perspective, just because it's authentic to who I am. But I remember hearing about the story of this one guy who loved to run. And he said, when I run as fast as I can, I know that it's just so pleasing to God. I know he made me, you know, this gift and this ability that maybe not a lot of people have in his bracket of like marathons and all that, you know, speed running. Sorry.
No. To take context to that, I mean, that it really, your brain is localizing focus. So in the scheme of, you were talking about a runner, you know, I've really begun to practice the, like, more of an art form of endurance sport. And it, you know, I haven't been perfect about my training, and, you know, I think for no other reason other than, you know, this pandemic shapes how I train, but, or not shapes how I train, but like kind of like how often I train right now. But endurance sport, I think, is really the one thing, like, it really shaped how I fight for myself. It's about, like, I think I had never had respect for myself throughout most of college. Like, I didn't know what standard to hold for myself, and I don't think I held a high enough standard to kind of, like, be the person that I wanted to be. And I think even now, like, I don't think you'll ever be specifically the person that you want to be until maybe, like, you have some lofty goal and you get there, like, 25 years or whatever later. But I just don't think I had goals. I didn't think I had benchmarks that really related to what my ultimate, like, kind of source of happiness was. And so I started this whole journey anxious, self-loathing, like, basically depressed, out of my mind, like, borderline, just kind of like, I mean, everybody drinks a lot in college, but, like, I don't know. I just drank for the wrong reasons. I was finding ways out, and endurance sport really brings you to God, whatever God that is. It brings you to the universe, because in the scope of conversation, your brain is thinking about maybe, like, what's happening now, what's going to happen a couple words from now, what the context is. It's focusing on a lot of things. When you run, you have one thing to figure out, and that's where the next step is going. And that's it. And your brain frees up the other compartments to just roam. And that's kind of what I felt is, you know, I go for a half marathon and my brain just kind of roams. It does its own thing. And it's really kind of, it's those moments, like doing like an 11 mile run the other day in the middle of the night, while the fireworks were going off, was just kind of like, it felt like I was having an out of body experience. It just didn't seem real. It felt very third person, where, like, I was just a conduit. I was just a vessel. Mm-hmm. But my eyes were seeing from a different place. Have you had like any spiritual moment while you've been running or anything like that?
Oh yeah. I can very much imagine what you're talking about. I think because I've experienced something like that, you just kind of get into this zone of you're tracking at a consistent pace. And it's almost like, you know, the same thing as meditation, when you're just sitting in a chair and you kind of find that rhythm of breathing, and it allows you to kind of, I guess, roam mentally and think about things that sometimes are just going on behind the scenes.
Yeah. I mean, our brains do a fantastic job of kind of masking up what the hell is going on. You know, like we got 1,001 things that our brain are like doing. I mean, we have to eat 3 times a day just to power it. You know, we need watts and watts and watts of power just to generate information and to like actually operate on a consistent basis. Like you said, you didn't get enough sleep. Like that's just your brain telling you like, yo, like I need more recharge time. Like at the end of the day. And, you know, a lot of people take advantage of them. They're like me included. Like we take advantage of what our bodies are capable of until they're not capable of it anymore. And then we have to like work our way back up again. You know, it's like, like, have you had like, have you had anything kind of like where you've experienced that, where like you had kind of like a hard set discipline, you kind of lost it and then picked it back up?
Yes, but I don't know if anything, you know, extraordinary out of the everyday circumstances of just like not finding a rhythm with sleep anymore, or just getting lazy and not getting exercise as much as I should have during college. Just kind of, yeah, the basic habits of wellness that I kind of got out of eating well and sleeping well and all those sorts of things. But I can't really dive That's deeper fair. Into that.
That's fair. I mean, you said food, like what kind of food for you? Like what's your jam?
What's my jam? Well, my mom cooks amazing Italian dishes. So anything that's pretty much pasta and meat sauce, lasagna, stuffed shells, carbs, Connor. That's where I don't think about what I'm eating and I just think about what I'm tasting.
Just like, oh, stuff in my face. Like, your dad even said Logan eats too many chips. I'm like,
he does. I eat too many chips. He's eating chips at like 9 a.m. this morning.
What kind of chips do you eat though?
Corn chips.
Is it like always corn chips or is it just he has like a wide variety of chip?
Always corn chips, Connor.
Always corn chips. Thing. I mean, like we're all creatures of habit. Like you're talking about you like Italian food. Like I've recently just gotten into like a 2 to 3 month rhythm of like almost every day has been a strong green shake and a peanut butter bagel. It's just like gets me going. A little bit of carbs, a little bit of nutty sugariness, and some like lemony flavor. Oh, I don't know why it works, but it works. Mm-hmm.
I think we're all different, Connor. I can't do it, man.
Well,
partly because of allergies. I can't eat all that stuff, but.
Oh, the yeah. Nut allergy?
Nut allergies, yeah. Good for you, though. Eat your Nutella and whatever the
you're talking about. How come some of my closest friends, they're nut allergic. And I'm like, I eat peanut butter for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Sounds like a taunt.
I mean, it's not a taunt. It's more of I am ecstatic to share my love of peanut butter. And then I recently found cashews and pistachios recently, which I had never had them in my life. And they're amazing. Nuts, man. Well, okay. So do you ever experiment with diet at all?
Nope.
Like, you don't experiment at all? Like, like you've never done like a ketogenic like cycle or anything?
Nope. I just kind of eat my normal routine of things.
Oh man. We got to get like, we should get you to like, we should do like a vegan challenge or something. Like, I don't think you could go vegan because without nuts, like, can you eat lentils? I don't know if those aren't a nut, they're a bean, but
yeah, I can eat lentils, beans.
I mean, you could eat lentils and black beans and like other beans, but like to have no seeds, to have no like grain, or like an actual seed like that, like that might be tough.
Would be tough, yeah.
I mean, I'm always experimenting. I like experimenting with responsibility.
Oh yeah, like what?
Well, I'm saying like right now, like I have my green shake here. It doesn't even look good, but it's caffeine, strong greens, and lion's mane. I've added lion's mane mushroom to my diet, and it's been great. Sometimes you microdose these things, like a lion's mane, and it's microdosed for a reason. That's you're not getting a physical effect, like something where you're saying like, oh, this is definitely different. Like when you get like, you know, a shot of like crazy strong espresso, you're like, this is like vibing through me. When you microdose something like lion's mane mushroom or maitake or reishi or cordyceps mushroom, if you microdose it, the whole point is to not have any perceivable effect. And I think with lion's mane, have you ever heard of lion's mane?
No, could you tell me what it is?
Yeah, sorry to like pop it. So lion's mane mushroom is just, it was a mushroom discovered in the early 2000s by a researcher, a friend of the company that I purchased from, a researcher friend of a man named Paul Stamets. So I found lion's mane mushroom through Paul Stamets, and Paul Stamets has kind of dedicated his life to the cultivation and information on mushrooms. So he has studied just volumes and volumes and volumes of different types of mushrooms. And so we found this lion's mane mushroom, and he was able to, and I would like obviously fact check all of it, but from my basic research and understanding is there is a quintessential like perceivable change in the brain's chemistry when using lion's mane, in that it decreases the amount of necrosis in the brain, the chemical that we produce in our brain that I forget what it's called, but it basically just sits in your brain. Like it's kind of like lactic acid in a muscle, but it just stays there. But it naturally, it's a precursor to Alzheimer's, where your brain just degrades and there's no memory formation, and you gradually lose your thought process, that type of thing. And lion's mane and turkey tail mushroom were both extremely beneficial in the reduction of this chemical in your brain that ultimately produced Alzheimer's. So it's really great for mental clarity and general brain function, based off of the research and based off of my usage. I would probably more so say, like, when you get up in the morning, you feel clear. Like you would probably say you remember your mornings more than your evenings, right?
Mm-hmm.
With lion's mane, I feel this mental acuity past 5 p.m. where I can say I remember everything from like five. Like I remember my whole day yesterday, and it's not like a boasting thing. Like a lot of people would probably say they remember what they did yesterday, but for me, I don't normally remember much past the day. And I remember a large portion of what happened yesterday in snippets in my brain. And I was extremely conscious from the moment I woke up at 8:30 to the moment I went to bed at 2 a.m. I felt very conscious and very purposeful with my time and my actions. And I think that is attributable to something like a lion's mane supplement or proper dosage of caffeine or other nootropic supplements. Hmm. So that is lion's mane in its full description.
I like the sound of that. That's cool.
And really, like something I like that you kind of asked me to describe it, because like something that is important to me is like there are so many things out there that we don't know, and there are so many things that are peddled to us that we don't know about. Especially for you, you talked about, well, we had to go to a doctor that kind of was in our charted territory to figure this shit out, and you figured it out. And in the same way, like there are so many mushrooms in the world, like. Don't get me into rabbit hole mushrooms, but like there are so many mushrooms in the world. How the hell are we not like studying them? There's some crazy portion of the world that's built by mushroom mycelium, by fungi mycelium. And this mycelium base makes up the fabric of the crust of the earth. And for us to instead peddle some type of human drug, like a chemotherapy or something for cancer, like how are we not looking for a natural remedy for natural causes of death or unnatural causes of death? You know, cancer was something documented in early humans, but you know, something now where, you know, we can change the course of history, and we can employ methods of holistic change, holistic benefit to our life. That's kind of what I stand for, I guess, in this day and age is like you go on TV, how many ads, Colin, would you say you see in between 20-minute portions of a TV show that you're watching?
Just ads in general?
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe 10, 5, but can't think well.
And you're, okay, so you say 10. Is that, like, and you didn't even say that in a surprising tone. Like, does that seem like a lot to you?
Getting into my TV consumption now. Yes, maybe. I don't know. Good question.
I asked because, like, look, the state or the country of Brazil literally banned, or maybe it was just Rio, but, São Paulo, but, like, Brazil banned, like, billboard advertising. They billed, like, any publicly outward advertising in their country. They're one of the very few people to do that. And conversely, America is like one of only two countries in the world that is allowed to produce medical, medicine-based infomercials or like call to action type commercials. Yeah, like we're one of, I think it's us and I want to say New Zealand are the only two countries that allow for medical like commercials to be aired on public broadcast. Wow. So out of the 10, yeah, I mean, like how many, let's say out of 10 ads that you see on TV, how many are pharma based?
Maybe 2 to 3, but literally every time there's like a wheel of commercials between, you know, episodes of something, it's always got something for medical purposes in there.
Or if you're watching Maury, it's like, if you or your loved one has been affected by mesothelioma, like, all those like file complaint. If you've had ovarian cancer in the last 5 years, like, dog, I didn't come here for this. I came here to see like if the dude's a father or not. Like, so I asked all this because like I like this conversation in the scope of you know, we had a specific way of life that we were living. Would you say like if you like X were like what we were before pandemic? The why, like the post, kind of this like during and post COVID type culture, I think is going to drastically change where like we see through a lot of the bullshit. Would you, I mean, like the system that we were in was not specifically working. It was working for some, but not all. And in the process of this conversation, I mean, like I'm kind of looking at specific places that people can find in themselves and not through product they can purchase or like if they could just figure things out for themselves. You know, I like that this conversation offers up like, well, I'm going through X or I'm going through a similar situation, but this person is able to kind of like forge his own way, he's able to find something that works for them. So I asked you a question before the podcast, and I think it's probably pertinent now, is like, so if you had, you would say like your biggest failure, like something where you said like, oh, I screwed up, like, hey, like, you know, this wasn't good. Like I failed certain people, or I failed myself. What was that situation? And, you know, how did you move forward from it?
It's a good question. I spent a lot of time, days thinking about this one to find something appropriate and relevant that I think a lot of people could empathize with. I would say, so you mentioned that I was in Peru. Mm-hmm. I spent a year there a couple of years ago teaching English as a foreign language. And the failure came in this way. It was a decision I made. I went, but I wasn't 100% committed to it at the time. And so for the first 2 to 3 months, I just felt this sense of being out of place. And I didn't know, I kept just thinking that I had made the wrong decision. I had kind of given up the opportunity to move back home and spend a lot of time with my parents and my grandparents who were aging at the time. And so I just kind of had this sense of I'm living a perpetual like Groundhog Day of just waking up every day and feeling I am stuck here for a year and I made the wrong choice.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was the sense of failure, was just not committing to it 100%. But I think through some conversations I had with friends, I kind of came to the point where I just said, you know, I'm never going to know if this discomfort or uncertainty is because I genuinely just made the wrong choice and need to do something to change it, or if it's just because I haven't given myself permission to enjoy this and to be fully present with the people and the culture that I'm with. And after I did that, it was after I realized that, it was an immediate change. I began like loving where I was and finding myself and just enjoying the experience. And by the time I was ready to go, by the time I had to leave, it was a real, real difficult movement back home. So much so that I've been trying to go back ever since. So I went back, as you said, last year for part of the summer, and I'm hoping to go back once I graduate again. So I think the life lesson that I learned was, when I do something, commit 100%, and if it doesn't work out, then I've learned that that's not the thing for me or the relationship for me. And the only way I'll ever actually know if it is if I do give my 100%.
Wow, that's super insightful. I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head, is like that full on 100% commitment. Like, you almost like you describe failure not even as failure, but it's just an outcome, objective. There is no, like, you didn't even put a label on it, which I like.
Yeah, good insight there too, Connor.
I mean, I empathize with a certain with another certain kind of situation, but just in general, the commitment aspect of so many things nowadays, like, people in general, from what I've recently experienced, people are very hard to commit. Like, people are very hard to commit to something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's always an out. There's something where, oh, this got in the way. Like, let's do something different. Let's reschedule or whatever. Like, and now more so than ever, like, we have a situation in life where, like, we have a pretty valid reason for, like, you know, whether it be, you know, for COVID, let's say for COVID, for blanket statement or blanket situation, just, you know, people have a reason not to do something or to not go out, to not do the thing. And like, do you think there's something that aids in a lack of commitment in other people?
Something that kind of makes them more, less likely to commit, you mean?
Yes, like more prone to like not committing to something.
This would be a good question for a psychologist or sociologist, but you're asking me, Colin. So I would say that.
I want your perspective.
I mean, the kind of general sense I get from people I talk to, people who I know have tried to diagnose this already, is just a fear of failure. So people just, including myself at times, are afraid of consequences, which sometimes are very real. Sometimes failures do bring terrible, you know, consequences with them. So it's not to be, you know, making light of being afraid to fail or being afraid of what could happen, losing a job. I don't know. Someone's really riding on you and you don't come through.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for a lot of us, at least when I'm looking back on my own experience, it is a fear of what could happen. And when we give ourselves at least a little bit of permission to just adventure out to where we might not have thought we would have been, or try something new, and just giving it that 100%, sometimes you will fail and you'll learn something from it, but sometimes you won't. Sometimes you'll have probably one of the great successes of your life.
I agree. I mean, did you, so were you facing like maybe like feelings of like predicting the future?
Yeah, I was. I just couldn't really see any other scenario when I was in Peru other than just not really advancing in my career, not becoming a good English teacher because I was kind of learning on the go. I'm a native speaker, but and I knew a little bit of kind of teaching pedagogy from previous experiences, but there's still a lot that I was trying to learn. And so it was just really hard to see any other alternative besides, I'm going to fail. I'm not going to enjoy this. I'm missing out on valuable time at home with my family. And like I mentioned, my grandparents who were getting up in age at that time. So yeah.
And so like the way those kind of like three tenets that you described when you were in that zone, when you left Peru, how would you like, what would be like three ways that you could describe like kind of like when you got back or like when you were leaving Peru, like what kind of, what was on your mind when you were leaving?
I would say I had become pretty grateful for the things that people had done for me to help me adjust. People were so willing to look out for me. Lots of times random strangers would just, I'd ask for directions and they would, you know, give me directions or they'd go out of their way. I remember there was this one time I worked in a nicer part of the city in Lima because I had the university there. And then I would commute to kind of the outskirts where I had a project going on. And it was a little bit dangerous there. And I remember this one time I got on one of the city buses and was trying to get to where I normally go, but I wouldn't take this route. And they took a detour through a pretty ugly in the sense of like dangerous. You knew this was not a good place to be part of town. Right. And they said, everyone's got to get off. Like, there's a detour ahead of us, just get off. And I said, I don't know where I'm going. How can you just leave me here? And this elderly woman sitting next to me on the bus just kind of took my hand, got off the bus with me and said, let's, you know, walk this way. I know where are you trying to go? I know how to get here. So I would say at least one of those three things, Connor, was just this profound sense of gratitude, not only for the way I felt, but also the kind of gratitude I saw in people around me. A second thing would be, I had just fallen into a deep sense of love for the culture I was in and some of the different values that I had encountered there. And then I guess a third thing would be, I mean, I was looking forward to coming home to seeing my family, but ending well is never easy. And so it's been a kind of a life lesson every time I move on from one stage of life to another, one place to another, to figure out how do I say thank you? How do I say I'm sorry for when I've messed up? And how do I transition smoothly and hopefully keep up some of those connections?
Damn, dude, you're setting us straight right now. That's extremely impactful. At least in my eyes, that's a, you've picked up some really beautiful gifts from a different land. And I, you know, I think it's just, there's a lot of people out there that probably are struggling right now with, you know, there are restrictions on their life, whether it be playing a sport or seeing other people. Like some people, for some people, this is the first time in their lives they've gone being pretty antisocial or having limitations on the things they want to do. Like for me, like I want to do triathlon, I want to do Ironman. And every time that there's a race, it's just going to cancel. I don't want to put my money on it. So like, you know, it's kind of a depressive, like I can only see a bad end. I can only see, you know, kind of like there is no end type of thing. I can only just sit and wallow. But, as soon as I can flip the switch and say to myself, like, well, this is just one thing, but I'm just predicting when things are going to happen. Like, I'm already predicting the future. And instead, like, I'm so grateful that my job gives me the opportunity to, like, the time, the space to do other things, say, like a podcast or to make art. I'm super happy and in love with endurance sports because of my training. It's something that gives me that meditation, that peace of mind. And in respect to triathlon, like I haven't even officially raced, and that's something that is like there's no closure, but I'm so grateful that I had the space and the time to set a goal and to do something like that, because I know that like when I was in peak training, I know I could do that Ironman. I know that in the last 2 weeks I've degraded, but but in the scope of those tenets of that journey, you went on a journey. You went from being one person to another, leaving Peru. In the same way, I went on my own journey. I found so many new things, and I came to a very similar place as you. I was just grateful to like just come up and swing the bat. And I don't know if that's something that you would kind of relate metaphorically. It's just like, you know, like I went out there and I gave it my best shot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, I think that's all we can really ask of ourselves, really, at the core of whatever we're doing. Like, we have to be open to allowing ourselves, like we have to be open to just giving ourselves a shot. Like, we can't shoot ourselves down before we've even done something.
I absolutely agree, Connor.
But I mean, look, I could do an entire other podcast with you just on Peru, because I'm sure there's just some wicked stories. Like, I would love to just talk to you about, you know, stories of the people of Peru and the life, just like in a different country. But mm-hmm. Even in saying that, you know, we're gonna have to obviously get you back on. But excuse me, for the, you know, just for the scope of, you know, what we're talking about today, like, you've just brought so many valuable insights to kind of the process of becoming stronger, better people as individuals, in such an objective way. So I really appreciate, you know, being able for you to be able to share with us some of the challenges you've gone through, some of the things you've learned, because I know you've made an impact on me today, and I know you're going to make a lot of impact with it, a lot of other people who listen to this podcast. So I just really wanted to say thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for, you know, just being an awesome human, man.
Thank you, Connor. It's been certainly a privilege and something I've loved to have just been able to keep up our friendship throughout the last like 25 years. Thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, man. I mean, we got the first 25 in the bag, so the next 25 shouldn't be so hard.
Not at all.
So, well, Colin, I will see you next time.
Okay. See you, Connor.
Peace.
Peace.